Israeli forces killed 3 Palestinians near Nablus, raising to over 80 the number of Palestinians they shot dead in the occupied West Bank this year. Iran says its agreement with Saudi Arabia to restore bilateral ties could facilitate ceasefire in Yemen and establishment of an inclusive government there. And the BBC is in hot water after it suspended one of its sports presenters who accused the UK government of using Nazi-era rhetoric in its immigration policy. Our top story. Israeli forces have shot dead 3 more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. This brings to 82 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers and settlers in 2023. Our correspondent in Ramallah tells us more about the latest developments.
Israeli soldiers from the Golani Brigade had deployed near the Israeli military checkpoint of Surra, West Nablus, when there had been clashes between Palestinian fighters there and the Israeli soldiers at that area. They claimed that Palestinian fighters opened fire at Israeli soldiers and a military position there. And then the Israeli forces succeeded to murder 3 Palestinian fighters and wounded a 4th and had taken him for investigation. The identity of the 4 Palestinians, including the 3 who had been killed, had not been revealed yet. The Palestinian Ministry of Health didn't confirm if it's true 3 Palestinians had been killed or not. This is an Israeli military statement who confirmed that the Israeli soldiers killed the 3 Palestinians this morning near Nablus and wounded and arrested a 4th Palestinian there. Anyways, the Palestinians in the city of Nablus had declared a day of mourning there and a general strike, but the identity of the 4 Palestinians had not been revealed yet.
Thousands of Israeli protesters have hit the streets for the 10th consecutive week to express their anger at judicial reforms proposed by the far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Protesters insist that they will continue to rally as long as the cabinet does not announce a freeze on the legislation. The organizers have vowed to intensify the demonstrations in the coming days. The protests turned violent in Tel Aviv and elsewhere on several occasions. Netanyahu returned to power as the regime's prime minister in late December, heading a coalition of far-right and extremist parties. The proposed reforms would limit the Supreme Court's ability to rule against the cabinet's decisions. Israel launches fresh airstrikes on Syria, this time targeting western and central provinces of Tartus and Hama. Syria's military says its air defenses intercepted some of the missiles. The attack left 3 Syrian army personnel injured and some material damage. Israel frequently carries out aerial attacks on Syria. Damascus says it reserves the right to respond. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, urging the international body to take action against Tel Aviv's aggression. Peter Ford is the former British ambassador to Syria, joining us live from the British city of Manchester. Peter, welcome. These Israeli bombing raids have increased since the Syrian government got the upper hand against the foreign-backed militants and terrorists. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think you have to see these Israeli raids more as part of their undeclared war on Iran than on very weak Syria. The Israelis say that what they're targeting in Syria are Iranian bases. Well, Iran has every right to be present in Syria and to provide aid in any form, civil or military, requested by the legitimate Syrian government. Therefore, these attacks have no foundation in law or ethics, but we have to interpret them more in the context of Iran-Israel relations than Israel-Syria. Syria represents absolutely no threat or potential threat to Israel, but the Israelis are fearful of Iran, which is a strong regional power. And I think what's happening here is that the Israelis have seen how Iran is improving regional relations. Just days ago, an agreement was reached in China with Chinese mediation between Saudi Arabia and Iran to reestablish relations. Israel is not happy about this. Anything that makes Iran stronger, they think, weakens Israel. Therefore, I would interpret the timing of this latest raid in that context. It's the Israelis signaling that even if Iran thinks it's making progress on one front, Israel can still strike Iran on another front.
Thanks to the then UK Home Secretary Priti Patel, who made a secret trip to Israeli field hospitals in occupied territories that were treating the militants that wreaked havoc in Syria. We know that, and then the story leaked and Patel was forced to resign when the Theresa May government said that it violated the government's protocols. In any case, thanks to her trip, we know that Israel treated field hospitals. She visited the hospitals. Does that not indicate or suggest to you that Israel is working hand by hand with the militants and the terrorists in Syria?
Yes, I think that's a fair comment. Israel has provided not just medical help, and that was done openly. The jihadis fled across the occupied Golan to Israeli medical centers. But more covertly, of course, the Israelis have been providing weapons, planning, communications, and other assistance to the variety of militias, extremist, fundamentalist militias, which based themselves in Syria and which are now, thankfully, corralled, cornered in the northwest corner of Syria. And from there, it's less possible for Israel to provide assistance. Nevertheless, Israel continues to provide propaganda support, diplomatic support. They put pressure on countries like Britain to give support to the jihadis and the people behind them, in the people who control Idlib. So the covert war goes on, with Israel providing assistance in many, many forms to ISIS and other jihadi groups.
Just finally, Peter, as a former ambassador to Syria, you must have seen the vast ethnicities and people of many backgrounds living happily and peacefully side by side, not just in Damascus, but across the country. I've seen it with my own eyes. I don't know if you have. If you have, does that not counter the Western narrative that the Syrian government waged war on its own people?
Well, this claim is totally absurd. It hardly deserves scrutiny. The Syrian government has been trying to pacify areas of Syria that were grabbed with Western covert assistance by jihadi militant groups. And thankfully, it has recovered control over most Syrian territory. I'm quite sure that most Syrian people desire only stability and are grateful to the government for having pacified their regions. And it speaks volumes that most of the internal refugees in Syria have been people fleeing not from the government areas, but from the jihadi-controlled areas into places like Latakia, which is still surrounded by refugee camps, people who come from Idlib and other jihadi-infested areas.
Okay, Peter, thank you very much indeed for that. Peter Ford is the former British ambassador to Syria, joining us live from the British city of Manchester. Moving on, Iran says its oil exports have reached their highest level since the U.S. reimposed sanctions on the country 4 years ago. Iran's oil minister says the country exported 83 million more oil barrels in the past 11 months compared to the same period the year before. He says it also represents 190 million more oil barrels exported compared to 2 years ago. The Iranian minister attributed the spike to exploiting all capacities, marketing, and modified contracts. In 2018, the U.S. reimposed sanctions on Iran after unilaterally withdrawing from the 2015 agreement known as the JCPOA. The agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia to restore ties will speed up achievement of a ceasefire in Yemen and establishment of an inclusive government in the country. Iran's permanent mission to the UN made the remark in a statement. The statement added that the agreement will have many positive effects on bilateral, regional, and international levels. It said the deal proves Iran's determination to use all regional capacities to promote all-out peace and stability and meet the collective interests of regional governments and nations. The agreement between Tehran and Riyadh was reached through a deal mediated by China. The deal will see the two countries restoring diplomatic ties within 2 months and reopening their respective embassies. The agreement has received wide welcome from the international community, but has angered Israeli officials. The occupying regime's opposition figures say it reflects the complete failure of the new extremist cabinet's foreign policy. Iran has unveiled and opened the mass production line for a new domestically developed training jet. Gizu Misha Ahmadi has the details.
A ribbon-cutting ceremony to go down in history, opening the production line of Iran's first homegrown jet trainer, Yasin. According to Iran's Defense Minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, the jet trainer is capable of carrying out combat missions as well as other tactical aerial warfare actions such as close air support or CAS, air-to-ground actions against hostile targets in close proximity of friendly forces.
Training good pilots is extremely important, and now with this homegrown jet trainer, we have technologically evolved significantly. This is considered a major step for our Air Force. The training period will now be shorter and more comprehensive.
Prior to this, jet pilot training was done outside Iran, and due to Western and U.S. sanctions, Iranian pilots could not receive training abroad.
We did ask for assistance, but no country in the world helped us. However, at the end of the day, it worked out for the best because we were able to develop the technology that we needed ourselves. Knowledge-based companies helped us a lot. In particular, I have to point out the design of the engine and also its aerodynamic design. All in all, Yasin is about 800 kilometers lighter than our first prototype, which is a significant achievement.
Iran started designing jet trainers over 10 years ago, creation of a prototype that was unveiled in 2019. The new version now includes state-of-the-art avionics, engine, landing gear, and full cockpit devices.
With all the equipment installed, this training jet is fully equipped and it can be used for training pilots in all different levels.
But there's more to Yasin than just training fighter jet pilots.
It is also a question of prestige. This jet trainer was made by our own scientists and inventors. Knowledge-based companies played a very important part. Obviously, it means great economic benefits, but other than that, it shows that we can stand on our own feet. This is the most important message.
In the next 2 years, three more Yasin jet trainers will be produced based on the requirements of Iran's Air Force.
Iran has made great achievements in the field of aviation, and this is a symbol of self-sufficiency of the Islamic Republic. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Ukraine and Russia are both claiming to have killed hundreds of enemy troops in a single day of fighting for control of the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut. A Ukrainian military spokesperson said over 220 Russian soldiers were killed in the town. On Saturday, Russia's defense ministry also said 210 Ukrainian troops were killed in the wider Donetsk region. The fighting in Donetsk is now focused on Bakhmut. There, a small river dividing the town is reportedly the new front line. That's after pro-Russian forces advanced on its eastern side. Capturing Bakhmut has been a key objective of Russia. It gives Russian forces control over almost the entire Donbass region. But Ukraine says its forces are holding back the Russian offensive. The BBC's director general says he will not resign after a backlash to the removal of Gary Lineker, the popular host of the broadcaster's Cornerstone soccer program. Tim Davies says the situation should be resolved calmly. Lineker was suspended after accusing the UK government of using Nazi-era rhetoric in its new immigration policy. His ouster set off a staff boycott, which forced the BBC to curtail major portions of its weekend sports coverage. Many politicians and public figures slammed the BBC's move, accusing the state-funded broadcaster of buckling to demands from the ruling Conservatives. Turning elsewhere, France's Senate has approved the government's controversial pension reforms bill. This came hours after hundreds of thousands of protesters took to the streets across the country to oppose President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular plan. The bill was passed by the upper chamber of the French Parliament by 195 votes to 112. Now it is another step closer to turning into a law. Early on Saturday, scuffles broke out between French police and demonstrators protesting the bill. The government seeks to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, arguing that it is the only way to prevent the collapse of the current system. That brings an end to World News.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical contaminations. But that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor within plus or minus 25 meters of the Nord Stream pipelines. The installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia, and did the munitions that we found close to the route. We had a number of chemical munitions.
The Nord Stream pipeline had to be constrained because so far no European country has the ability for cleaning up the chemical munitions. Americans who, far from their own shores, have now discovered a danger close to home, now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused were dumped by the military all around the U.S.
Working on a investigation, a local disposal of military bases. When I saw photographs in the 1950s and 1940s of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and Lewisite and loaded up on barges being photographs of barrels of being thrown overboard, they were conclusive that they were a number of dump sites of them off of 11 different states, presumably off of some coasts of some other. Well, that was an eye-opener. Dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to 8 degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them, the beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball, laying in the sun. It is water, presumably around 12,000 out near the continental shelf. That's where their records, this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certainty far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea that there were potential dangers, that they were shocked that there was little in the way of active of these dump sites or in the way of some research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones. Fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't have any idea.
Of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called to increase its efforts to locate dump. Work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons.
Here has been mostly archival research on when we started, where we started dumping. White binders are pretty much all that in the last 5 years, the chemical weapons disposals and some in the U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together. This is because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable, not be reconditioned. So you've got that. All of a sudden, you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. Wait a minute. Now I know what they did with them. Boat. So we go and we find the logbook. Hopefully the Latlongs. How long did it take him? And when he went back, time that you find something's up, it's like, I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with this. How long would that take you to put together? I don't doubt.
William Brankovitz was the first to test chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense in the 80s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons. And we all share some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was excess to anyone's needs. So weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. People became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of missiles that were planned at the end of the 1960s in an operation called Operation Chase. The land was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, realized that there were potential problems. And so they asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemicals. And we moved away at that disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later in 1970, there was a congressional act that made...
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump, and if you dump something into the effects, when you understand that today we're taking a look to see what those effects are, we're the fish, we're looking at the biota in the sea to see what has had to determine whether it's an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, or more years. In some cases, there's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that's been to slowly dissolve. And when we're not finding a adverse impact to life, safety is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the an understanding on the effect on people and understanding what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-adverse manner of handling?
United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientists in the sea and the dangers they pose has been under this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired army mined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach, a crusader for cleaner.
Good afternoon, I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is the program, A Conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer and explosive ordnance disposal, more than 30 years experience, and he. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have Upper Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking, there's actually five munition sites in light from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemistry. Everything was secret. They were actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at it. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. It said it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. Looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had, and then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting different munition sites all along the eastern sea, coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of, we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at we discussed the different sites. Two recommendations came out, an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the international platform for munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall. And I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. We used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bordeaux Lakes. Terry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bordeaux Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factor in our seven generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bedora Lakes, but they haven't denied it either, and for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas. Well, Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. One million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons. And many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea. Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support cleanup efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act, because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough. نقیم الدین ولا
تتفرقوا فیه. مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
This is this for is, a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is for a better life from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol. I am at your service to talk about another strategy that helps us enjoy a more appropriate life based on the concepts of the Quran and Islamic narrations. Today I want to talk about the advantage of having a lot of friends. Human is a creature who cannot live without the help of others. Human life is formed by Allah in such a way that the continuation of his life is only possible in the framework of a social network, social interactions and personal relationships. And a person by his own can never acquire all of his requirements and needs. For example, a person cannot be a baker and at the same time a farmer, a doctor, an architect and the like. And a person cannot gain all the skills he needs in his life. But in a community, everyone undertakes a part of the social needs, and with these social interactions, all the different needs of the people who live in a society will be met. On this basis, a person who is in contact with more people, the people who have different useful abilities, that person, of course, will enjoy a better and more comfortable life. Because of this, someone who has a lot of friends, or in better words, a bundle of friends with many skills, different abilities, useful talents, influence, and practical experience and knowledge, such a person is more fortunate and more successful. Due to this fact, in Islamic traditions, it is mentioned that one of the most important assets and supply of a person is his close friends. One of the most precious thing one can have in his life is his close friends. And having more friends leads to the improvement of life. Having friends is not only useful when someone needs help and when someone faces a problem, but it is also useful and enjoyable when someone gets along with them to have some, what to say, recreational activities and to also benefit from their friends' experiences and opinions. So having a friend can bring about different benefits for a person in his life.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
It is also interesting to note that making good friends is an easy task. It is not like acquiring wealth, which requires a lot of efforts and sometimes requires large investments. No, making a friend usually will be done easily. Making friends is not like, for example, gaining social positions, which requires strong social relations. To get a friend can be done through practicing some Islamic merits like openness, politeness, and good company and sociability. Because of this, I mean because finding a friend can be done somehow easily, Imam Ali says in one of his noble sayings in Nahj al-Balagha, أَعْجَزُ النَّاسِ مَنْ عَجَزَ أَنْ اِكْتِسَابِ الْإِخْوَانِ. The weakest person is the one who is unable to make friends. Then the Imam continues, وَأَعْجَزُ مِنْهُ مَنْ ضَيَّعَ مَنْ ظَفَرَ بِهِ مِنْهُمْ. But the weaker and still more unable than him, than someone who cannot gain friend, is someone who has such a friend, but then loses him. So, the person who loses his friends through unkindness or misbehavior or mistreatment is more unable than a person who could not gain friends. Having enough friends is so important that Imam Ali says in another hadith, مَنْ لَا صَدِيقَ لَهْ لَا ظُخْرَ لَهْ. A person who does not have a friend does not have a supply. We also have experienced a lot that when we encounter a problem, we firstly try to solve it by ourselves. But when we feel that we cannot easily solve the problem, the next thing that comes to our mind is whether we have a friend or an acquaintance to help us or not. When we face a problem, we often firstly go to our cell phone contact list and check the names of people to see if there is a friend who can do something for our benefit or not. For example, if you are driving and the car breaks down, we firstly think about a friend who is a repairman. If it gets sick, we firstly think about a friend who is a doctor. A doctor who knows us and we also know him. Imam Sadiq says in a noble hadith that the status of a friend is so high and so prominent to the extent that in the day of judgment, that when some of the criminals will be condemned by the order of God to go into the hell, they of course regret and seek for someone to help them. But here, what is interesting is that they, before seeking for any relatives to help them, they say, as if we have a friend to help us. Then the Imam recites this verse of the Quran that the people of the hell cry and say, فَمَا لَنَا مِنْ شَافِعِينَ وَلَا صَدِيقٍ حَمِيمٍ. Today, when we are in the hell, we have neither an intercessor nor a warm and loving friend. Pay attention that those people in the hell do not say, as if we have some relatives to help us. But they regret that they don't have a close friend, a bosom friend. The fact is that even a close relative supports a person only if he is actually a close friend. If a relative is not really a friend, he cannot help us. Allah. Let me summarize my words. It is usually easy to attract others' attention and become their friends and choose them as our friends. One can make friends by good manners and cheerfulness, and by practicing good behavior, hospitality, and by acting in accordance to Islamic ethics. Friends can help us celebrate good times and provide support during bad times. Friends prevent isolation and loneliness. Even those who have higher social needs, they are in need of a greater number of friends, because since the realm of their work are extended and vaster, they are in need of more friends to undertake different parts of their activities. Regarding the importance of friends, it is interesting to note that one of the educated men was once asked, "Is a brother better or a good friend?" And the man said, "A good brother who is a friend is better." Of course, it should be noted that having many friends never means that a person wastes his precious time by hanging out with them. It means that a person who has more friends will benefit from them when he needs help, when he needs some experience, or to be with them to reduce some of his daily fatigues. Again, as I mentioned several times in this program, having a friend by itself is not a value. What makes a friend valuable is a friend who can help us. A friend who, if we are with him, he reminds us about the mercy of God. He says something that makes us closer to God. Good friends that when a person is with them, they help him to get closer to God. And good friends who are ready to help us for the sake of God, they are the best assets for man whose value cannot be calculated. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.